The streets of Paris are packed with cheering crowds, all waiting to catch a glimpse of the automobile that had done the impossible. Driven all the way to France from Peking, China, more than 10,000 miles over some of the world's roughest terrain. The date was August 10th, 1907. Almost a year prior, a French newspaper called Le Matin had challenged the world's burgeoning auto industry to prove the supremacy of their cars by means of a race across Asia and Europe. Many thought it couldn't be done. After all, the automotive industry was in its infancy, and cars weren't seen as reliable as horses yet. It had been just 2 decades since Carl Benz patented the world's first production motor vehicle, and Henry Ford's Model T wouldn't debut for another year. The Chinese didn't even have a word for car yet. But thanks to some of the very first maniacs to ever fall in love with cars, it happened. And just 2 months after the race began, the first place finisher was parading down Champs-Élysées. This is the story of the first race from Peking to Paris.
Best-ass podcast. It's about cars, it's not about forts.
It's Champs-Élysées.
God damn it, Joe.
Champs-Élysées. Champs-Élysées.
Anyway, welcome back to Past Gas. I'm your host, Nolan Sykes, joined as always by my other hosts on the show. It's James Pumphrey. Hello.
Toot toot.
And Joe Weber. And I extend another hello to you too, sir.
Keep it juiced.
Keep it juiced.
Well, today we're talking about the first trans, not transatlantic. One of the very first motor races in
but,
history.
You know, it's still pretty good. It's not like they drove across the Atlantic or nothing, but, you know, it's far, too.
Wait, is this the race that Whoopi Goldberg was in with a car with Seth Green?
Mousetrap, starring Nathan Lane. Loved that movie when I was a kid. Not that that has anything to do with it. I think we should just get into it. How about that? It's all right. In January 1907... a challenge appeared on the front page of Le Matin. James, could you give me your best French accent here?
Is there anyone who will undertake to travel this summer from Paris to Peking by automobile? Whoever he is, this tough and daring man, whose gallant car will have a dozen nations watching its progress, he will certainly deserve to have his name spoken as a byword in the four quarters of the earth.
Dang, yeah. So we all know this quote already because I did not realize this, but this race is part of the very first episode of Wheelhouse.
Yeah, why are race cars red?
Anyway, the newspaper dubbed it a stupendous challenge.
A stupendous challenge. It would be a stupendous challenge for any man with any car.
Le Matin.
No horses allowed. No horses allowed.
Le Matin. Organized the race with 2 goals in mind. The first was publicity for the paper itself, and the second was to promote the French car industry, which had not gained the same traction as manufacturers from Italy, England, and the United States. Using the somewhat recent spread of the telegraph across Asia, they planned to publish live dispatches from reporters traveling with the race to drum up excitement for both. Initial interest in the challenge was high, with over 40 entrants submitting their intention to participate, but by the time the deposit of 2,000 francs, or about $35,000 today, was paid, the field was whittled down to just 5. Most fervent among those were 2 men of completely opposite means and personality. I feel like we're going to get some protagonists in the story.
Ooh,
now.
Yeah, but they're an odd couple.
One of them's messy and one of them's neat.
On one side was Prince Scipione Borghese, a well-known Italian diplomat, explorer, and mountain climber who had previously journeyed across Asia from Beirut to Peking, which is now known as Beijing.
Mm.
Upon reading the call to action in Le Matin, he immediately wrote to the newspaper that he would be participating, which helped lend credibility to the challenge. His no-nonsense demeanor was clear from the start. He quickly commissioned a car from an early auto manufacturer based out of Turin, Italia, and began meticulously planning his journey. What?
This is the guy. This is the guy who had the red car, the Italia mod. It was
This is the guy. This is the guy I was telling you about.
Yeah, I believe Prince. This car had about 40 horsepower.
The Prince Borghese. Borghese enlisted the Russian petroleum company Nobel to deliver fuel deposits across the Russian Empire at no cost to him.
Sponsorship, baby.
Yeah, baby. Yeah. Friggin' fuel companies have been sponsoring races since the beginning. At this point, gasoline was more commonly used in dry cleaning than in cars. So Nobel had a huge incentive to prove that it was possible to drive through Russia. Borghese also brought on his personal mechanic, a former train engineer named Ettore Guizzardi. Borghese also brought on his personal mechanic, a former train engineer named Ettore Guizzardi, to accompany him on the trip. On the other end of the spectrum, professional driver Charles Goddard could best be described as a charming lunatic. The type.
One of those swashbuckling types, you know?
Yeah.
Probably wears like a leather bracelet.
Mm-hmm.
Like a bracer.
Mm-hmm. He's got like the heartogram tattoo.
Yeah.
He hangs out with Bam all the time.
Yeah, he's got Chelsea boots for sure. He's got to be so sexy, we don't care that he's a stick in the mud. We still want him.
Yeah.
We still want him on our team. We still want him at our dinner table. You know what I mean? So on the other end of the spectrum, from the sexy Italian Prince Borghese, on the other side of the spectrum was sexy professional driver Charles Goddard, who could best be described as a charming lunatic. When the challenge was announced, Goddard was riding motorcycles in a small Parisian stunt show called Le Wall of Death. However, he managed to secure a spot driving for the Belgian company Metallurgique.
I think it's just Metallurgic.
Metallurgic?
Yeah.
He had managed to secure a spot driving for the Belgian company Metallurgique in the Peking to Paris raid, as it was being called at this point. Le Matin had decided to reverse the order of the race to avoid China's rainy season. While the other entrants were worried about the hazards of off-roading over countless mountain ranges through the Great Wall of China, into the Gobi Desert, across Siberia, and down through mainland Europe, Goddard was delighted. He simply loved driving, despite not knowing a lick about how cars actually worked. Sounds familiar. Cole Trickle, Days of Thunder. Loosely based on Goddard. Unfortunately for him, Metallurgique got cold feet about the cost of shipping a car and driving to China. Goddard was disappointed but not deterred, and traveled to Amsterdam to convince a Dutch company called Spyker that sponsoring an entry in the raid would more than pay for itself in publicity.
That's awesome. I didn't know that Spyker had been around for that long.
I assume Spyker is an energy drink.
Yeah.
Drink some Spyker. It'll give you spines.
It's made out of heroin. It's 1907. Drink Spyker Energy. It's made out of cocaine.
It's got radium. Now with radium.
Now with 20% more radium.
I just imagine that there's a lot of pulp from the ground up sea anemones that they're using in the formula.
What if there's just like ambiguous pulp that they don't ever say what fruit is from?
Just pulp.
Spyker's got everything you need to be healthy. Hooves, meat fats, cocaine, mercury, and radium.
Spyker was interested, but the company was nearly broke. To make matters worse, mere weeks after Le Matin published the challenge, company co-founder Hendrik Spyker, spelt different, and a British banker whom he had convinced to lend the company funds were both killed in a steamship accident while traveling from England to Holland.
It's crazy.
But Henrik's older brother, Jacobus, liked Goddard's passion and agreed to give Goddard... Hey, don't make fun of him. His brother just died. Come on, guys.
I know.
Yeah, his name is hilarious.
His name is Jacobus.
Jacobus. And Jacobus agreed to give Goddard a car and lend him the entry fee.
He's probably like, yeah, okay, you can have a car.
Hey, man, I know your brother just died, but can I get that entry fee real quick?
Yeah.
Okay, cool, man. Yeah, really sorry
taste
about
this. Taste this.
Yeah.
Taste this. Yeah, okay. It's a new formula for Spiker. Yeah. He's like, it's got more gunpowder in it.
Yeah, it's kind of like, it's kind of, ooh.
What's did that pulp I'm tasting?
Yeah, what's that pulp?
Don't worry about the pulp. Did you see your pants? Did you shit your pants?
I have. Am I gonna shit my pants?
Did that drink just make you shit your pants?
Yeah. Yeah. It's still doing it.
Yep. It's still going.
Still doing it.
Oh, God.
Back to the drawing board, fellas.
It smells good.
Good smelling diarrhea is a side effect.
Oh, I'm really conflicted on this product. Anyway, thank you for the entry fee. I gotta go home.
Though he told Goddard that he would not pay for anything else, Goddard promptly sold every spare part that came on the Spiker to pay for his passage to China. Of the other three entries, so this guy was just like broke.
Yeah. He wanted to race, man.
He broke.
He was a motorcycle stuntman in Paris. Like
1907.
Yeah, he's probably not making a ton of money. Like, he's not the great Goddard. He's just a guy in, like, a motorcycle ensemble.
Yeah, he's like the guy at Universal Studios that does the Waterworld show 10 times a day and risks his life for, like, $50 a pop.
Yeah, he's not the great Goddard. He's Charlie. I need you to ride into a lion's mouth this afternoon.
Okay.
I will give you a bonus of... a piece of bread.
It's 11.
You're too kind to me.
Of the other three entries, Georges Cormier was the most formidable driver. He was a car salesman for the French company de Dion Bouton, who hired him to lead their two entries. He recruited a quiet countryman named Victor Collignon to drive the second vehicle, and between them, they shared a mechanic from de Dion factory. A veteran shipbuilder named Jean Bizac, who had somehow never ridden in a car before.
Yeah. I just work on them. I don't ride in them.
Yeah, Not for me.
I get car sick, actually. So I don't know why I'm going on this 10,000-mile journey.
You've never been in a car. How do you know that you've been car sick?
I've ridden on a merry-go-round.
You put that car in the ocean, though? You call it a boat? I've been on a boat.
Never been sick on a boat.
Never been seasick.
Like how all three of us are doing this one guy.
Yeah.
Jean Bizac. Love it.
Borghese's Itala was the most powerful of these four entries, sporting 40 hearse purrs and weighing over a ton fully loaded with gear, which is not a lot.
That's not that much.
But with 40 horsepower, it's pretty low power to weight ratio.
Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, the Spiker sported a more modest 15 horsepower engine, while both the Dion's produced 10 horsepower. But they all outpowered the fifth and final entry, a 6 horsepower, 3-wheeled Kantal Mototri driven by the enthusiastic young Auguste Pons and supported by his mechanic, Octave Foucault.
I wonder if Auguste Pons is related to Lele Pons, you know?
Or Fabrizia Pons.
Or Fabrizio Pons.
Or Augustus Gloop. That's how I picture him.
You know.
Oh, I brought my Mototri. And I'm going to Mototri my best.
I like the idea of the fattest entrant in this race in a 3-wheeled car that has the least horsepower.
Yeah. Here we go.
Pons picked the Mototri, the 3-wheeled, because it weighed only 700 kilograms, half of the Spiker and a third of the Italia.
And a quarter of Pons himself.
And a quarter of Pons himself.
I like it because it's small.
With countless miles of rough terrain ahead, the men figured that if they ran into anything they couldn't drive through, they could simply pick up and carry the car instead. So, I mean, the this thing still weighed 1,500 pounds, so they'd both be like deadlifting 750 pounds.
on yeah, mountainsides.
Yeah.
Like, I would just carry it over the mountain.
It's amazing how like it seems like little foresight went into this race when it's really just like a life or death thing. Like you mess one thing up and you're dead.
Yeah. The five drivers, and there's like no medicine.
Well, hey, they got Spiker. Yet. They got Spiker.
Yeah. Oh, so. Yeah, they got a free Spiker. But, yeah, like if you break your leg in a city, you're probably going to die or lose your leg back then. The five drivers and the representatives agreed to a June 10th start date and only one major rule. All the entries had to stay together and help each other through the most dangerous part of the raid by caravanning until they reached Moscow, at which point it would be every man for himself to Paris. With that, they set off on ships to Peking. Using his foresight and tremendous resources, Prince Borghese traveled ahead of the others to survey the path out of Peking and into the Jundu Mountains. He scouted on horseback, carrying a wooden pole exactly as wide as the Italia to make sure it would fit.
That's smart.
Cool. Smart. Yeah. Very smart.
Elsewhere, Godard quickly became the life of the party on the ship he shared with the other entries and the Le Matin journalist, even as he struggled to acquire more funding for the trip via telegraph. But little did they all know, the raid was under threat of ending before it began.
Whoa. China's foreign council, known as the Waiwapu, didn't want it to happen. China was just 6 years removed from the end of the Boxer Rebellion, in which an anti-imperial Chinese faction tried to eject European trade powers from the country. The European powers eventually won through sheer military force, but the Waiwapu's leader remained suspicious of the West. He assumed that the raid was a cover for European spies to sow discord in the Chinese mainland, or possibly a test for a land invasion from the West via automobile.
I think those are legitimate concerns.
Pretty reasonable concerns, I will agree. And as a result, the Chinese government's position was to be as unhelpful as possible to these chichos, the term they invented for cars that roughly translates to oil chariots.
Dude, we should start calling cars chichos.
Chichos.
Yeah, my chicho.
Got the new chicho outside. but because of the treaty that ended the Boxer Rebellion, the Waiwapu did not have the power to officially reject the racers. Instead, they did everything they could to make Le Matin or drivers cancel the raid themselves. And guess what, fellas? It almost worked. The raid was nearly canceled twice due to the Chinese government's efforts, which included a refusal to grant the drivers passports into Mongolia. The first time was before the majority of the drivers had left Europe. The second was mere days before the raid's official start.
Maybe they shouldn't have called it a raid.
Yeah, you know, branding is so important in life. If you call
they
it a raid...
They probably should have, like, explained cars to Chinese people, too, before. It's like they're trying to bring these huge machines into their country and do a raid with them. Like, I wouldn't let those people in.
I don't know. They want to come do an oil chariot raid? is that cool? What? No.
I mean, if they wanted an easier time, they should have called, not a raid, but like a chicho.
Fun run.
Fun run, a celebration of the automobile, perhaps. Something
cruise.
That's a little more like cruise, something a little more benign, you know?
A Toys for Tots.
Toys for Tots never raises any suspicion. So anyway, George Cormier in particular worried about the driver's safety without passports. And also saw business opportunity. These were the only cars in all of China. If the race was canceled, they could be sold for a tidy profit. Hey, man, cut your losses, but make that money back. But Borghese and Goddard wouldn't hear of it. Both drivers insisted they would press forward with the raid, even if no one else did, even if the government didn't issue them passports. Cormier and the Waiwapu both eventually caved to the pressure, and the race was on. The raid launched on June 10th, 1907, with a lavish send-off from Peking. The rainy season had come early, muddying up the streets, but it wouldn't stop the festivities. Accompanied by fireworks and a military band, the cars roared out of the French ministry compound into the streets, crowded with Chinese citizens. Led by Cormier, the parade of cars made their way to the city wall and out the enormous gate of Virtue Triumphant into the surrounding plains. The race was on. Conditions were immediately terrible. Despite Le Matin's attempts to avoid the bad weather, the early rain made the drive into the Jundu Mountains nearly impassable. All the teams were forced to hire porters to drag and carry their cars through narrow river gorges and up into the dizzying heights of the mountain range. So already they're not driving. This meant that each car had to be as light as possible. So all the drivers had to dump many of the extra supplies they carried, except Borghese, who had the body of his heavy Atala mod removed and carried separately by an extra team of porters.
You got that cash. Why not?
Yeah, dude, spend it. Goddard was sad to lose his food and drink reserves, especially that sweet, sweet Spiker energy drink, particularly a free case of champagne he was gifted at the starting line. Why would you bring that with you? I mean, why not wait till the end? Anyway, he was so broke that in order to pay for his accommodations, food, and fuel, as well as the dog he adopted from a Peking market, this dude's bringing champagne and a dog?
Yeah.
Doesn't seem like he's great at managing money. I'm just going to say
that.
He
really doesn't. No. Yeah, he scammed 5,000 francs out of the Dutch minister in Peking by falsifying a letter of credit from the owner of Spiker. So he's scamming it up. He's racing. Like, you know what? This might be one of the first like motor races ever. But the cliches of motor drivers are already here. You got the rich guy who just pays for everything. Yeah. And you got a guy like Goddard who's just faking his way through it.
He's like
scamming people along the way.
He's like the Smokey Eunuch character who's kind of a grifter.
He's for definitely played by a young Harrison Ford.
But like CGI Harrison Ford.
Or the kid from Solo. That guy did a great job. But anyway, it's just amazing that the cliche racer tropes are already here in like the first race ever. I'm just amazed by that. Anyway, including that debt as well as the money that he had borrowed from Jacobus Spiker and the Le Matin reporter Jean Tutaïs, Goddard was in the hole 15,400 francs, which is over $250,000 today. And on top of that, his fuel was only paid for through the Russian border. So he had to still had a lot of things to figure out. Even with the reduced weight, the mountains outside Peking were dangerous for porters and drivers alike. Each car had to be dragged over the tops of boulders, risking damage to their primitive chassis. And then once they peaked each boulder, more porters had to pull on the car from behind, or both of the car and the drivers would crash down the other side. Oh my God.
Wait, so the drivers are just in the car as it's being pulled? Why don't you help?
Other areas of the path were too narrow, so the porters were forced to clear the way with pickaxes. Oh my God. There's also the language barrier to contend with, and most of the workers ended up becoming opium addicts. In other words, it was a slow-going journey. Come on, man. What a disaster.
This is not even the first leg of it.
I'm already disappointed with these guys.
We'll be right back with more of this story, but first, a word from our sponsors.
August Pons in the three-wheel Cantal had especially bad problems. His car was the easiest to lift, but is also terribly balanced. A passenger seat above the front two wheels, so it's not even, oh my goodness. A passenger seat above the front two wheels made the car extremely front heavy. So Pons struggled to get traction with his single back wheel.
It's just a spinning back there.
And even when he was able to drive it, the back wheel would bounce into ruts left by ox-driven wagons, meaning the Cantal could barely steer through the narrow mountain passes.
Oh my God.
I'm having a real hard time of it.
But after several days of struggle, all five cars eventually made it over the mountains, through the Great Wall, and into Mongolia, with Prince Borghese in the lead.
Just before they entered the Gobi Desert, the five teams shared a campsite along with the reporters who traveled in the raid. Dutali of Le Martin in Goddard's car, and the Italian journalists Luigi Barzini and Borghese with Borghese and Edgardo Longoni with Cormier. It would end up being the last time that the group was in one place. Pon set out first the next morning because he had been constantly falling behind the caravan. The other drivers followed, hoping that if Pon's encountered more trouble, they could help him without slowing themselves. First was Comier and Collignon in the De Dion's, followed by Godard in his Spiker, then finally Borghese in the powerful Atala. To stay on track, the drivers followed a route laid out by telegraph poles between their campsite and the next stop, a remote telegraph station where Le Matin had planned a fuel drop. Pons indeed ran into more car trouble, running out of gas well before the refueling point. What happened next is a point of contention. Pons had already fallen behind all three French drivers when he broke down, so Borghese, at the back of the pack, was in a position to know that Pons was stuck. However, when Borghese caught up with Godard that same day, he claimed that Pons was fine. Was it a misunderstanding?
Or was it sabotage?
Either way, Pons never reached the telegraph station that night. According to the caravan agreement, Borghese should have retraced their route to rescue Pons and Foucault, because he had the fastest car. Instead, Borghese told the others he would continue toward Paris. When pressed, he suggested that Pons would be fine because the drivers had not yet left inhabited land. The other drivers, when faced with returning to find Pons or letting Borghese get a day ahead in the raid, regretfully decided to push on as well. With guilty consciences, Godard and Dutally sent riders on horseback to find the Cantal. But when they found him, he was a fat skeleton.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it's like, I know we made this like packed, but like, yeah. Nah.
And it's not like you're going that fast anyway. Like, why not just take the time? Like, you spent days carrying your cars over these mountains. Like, you can afford to burn some more time going to get the other dude, you know?
Right, the race is a year long.
Yeah, come on, man.
Before they could continue, the drivers faced another problem. The fuel drop had arrived with leaky tanks.
Oh, no.
So much of the gas had evaporated.
Oof.
With Pons absent, Borghese and the two De Dion drivers all took what amounted to their full share. But Godard did not want to force Pons from the raid. He decided to take less gas and leave some behind in case Pons eventually made it to the station. Godard is the gauze. He's a good guy.
I am rooting for Godard here.
Yeah.
Because he's like a scallywag, but he's got honor.
Yeah.
Yeah, Borghese just like immediately gave up all his integrity. Just like,
I do not care about.
I'm going to win.
The lone wolf does not care about the weak sheep.
You had twice the amount of porters that we did. You're not a lone wolf.
Hey, even the lone wolf needs a porter or two.
This noble decision left the Spiker without enough gas to make it through the desert. Godard wired to the next telegraph station where a larger fuel supply was waiting and asked the operator to send out a camel loaded with gas tanks to meet him.
Wow.
Godard reasoned that he could borrow enough fuel from the De Dion's in order to reach the camel driver. But his level of worry was clear to Dutally's later in the day when Godard realized he forgot his dog
the telegraph station.
Oh, no. But refused to return to retriever.
Oh. Yeah, it's just a dog. It's 1907. It's just a dog.
It's just a dog.
I think the dog is better off, honestly, not being on this journey.
I forgot my freaking dog.
If the dog had stayed with them, there's a
good chance it would be eaten.
Yeah, I was about to say that. Yeah, good chance it would find its way into a can of Spiker, if you know what I'm saying.
As the others made their way across the Gobi, Pons and Foucault remained stuck. The riders sent by Godard and Dutally never reached him. The two Frenchmen spent several days stranded at the edge of the desert, nearly died of exposure before stumbling across a tribe of Mongolian nomads who nursed them back to health. After they were eventually rescued by a team from Le Montine, Pons claimed he was betrayed by the other drivers.
"They tricked me."
His Cantal was left to rust in the Mongolian desert.
Dang.
Meanwhile, Godard faced his own problems. He managed to beg some gas from Cormier and Collignon, but they claimed to be low themselves and didn't give Godard enough to make it through the desert.
Sorry, we barely have enough gas for ourselves.
Yes, yes, we barely have enough gas for ourselves. Sorry, Godard.
When he eventually ran out, he tried to ask the Dedeon drivers for help a second time, but they rumbled past him without stopping.
So much for that agreement, huh?
I was about to say, I think this really shows, like...
Au revoir, monsieur.
In these dire situations, like, they are, like, you know, the lack of forethought that went into this. They're like, yeah, of course we'll just have an agreement. We'll help each other to Russia. But then, like, when things start getting actually hard and you have to start making these really hard decisions, like, certain people are going to, like, be dicks, you know? Yeah.
Straight up. Well put. Straight up. That left Godard and Dutali stuck in the middle of the Gobi Desert as temperatures reached 116 degrees.
Ugh.
Cormier and Borghese both later claimed to have passed the camel driver with Godard's requested fuel, but that supply never made it to the spiker. Instead, Godard and Dutali huddled in the shade of their vehicle for nearly 2 days, subsisting on dry cubes of condensed soup and drinking oily water from the spiker's radiator.
Oh my god. Dang, our boys almost died.
Wow.
Yeah, dude.
Dry cubes of condensed soup sounds really good, though. I'm not gonna
dry cubes of condensed soup.
In the midst of their ordeal, they were discovered by a lone woman on camelback who tried and failed to tow the car with her mount. Later that night, they were passed by a caravan of merchants who left them for dead. With their emergency supplies completely gone and Dutali battling a case of dysentery he had picked up in China, a strangely cheerful Godard proclaimed he was going prospecting and wandered off into the desert.
What? What?
2 hours later, he miraculously returned. Of course he did, Godard. And he was riding on horseback with a troop of Kungus tribesmen.
Hell yeah.
Via pantomime sign language, Godard managed to negotiate for the tribesmen to ride ahead and retrieve the spiker's fuel deposit, plus lend the Frenchman 2 camels to start towing them towards the telegraph station. 44 hours after breaking down,
Godard was back in the race.
Wow. Hell yeah, our boy,
that's
dude.
That's such a come up. It almost makes me seem, or makes it seem that they were just like on the edge of like a mountain or something, and there was just like a tribe right over the mountain, and they never thought to like look over.
Meanwhile, that was really beautiful, Joe. It was really well put.
A lot of mountains in the desert.
Meanwhile, Prince Borghese was finally running into his own trouble. Finally. After making it through the Gobi, the Italia was the first entry to cross into Russia, where the route promptly ran into a large lake. Lamartine had given the drivers permission to put their cars aboard a ferry to cross the lake, but Borghese was determined to drive as far as he could. Attempting to circumnavigate the lake forced the prince, his mechanic, Guizzardi, and the reporter, Barzini, to cross a series of wooden bridges that had fallen into disrepair. They developed a foolproof technique to get across the rickety bridges.
Drive as fast as possible.
This worked great until it very spectacularly didn't. Halfway around the lake, one of the bridges finally gave way and sent the car tumbling backwards into the river below. Local police officer who had been traveling alongside the party immediately ran for help and then immediately puked. he puked. It was so gross, assuming that the 3 Italians were dead. But amid the disaster, luck was still on the prince's side. They landed on a duck, and the duck took off and flew them all the way to Paris, and they won. The end. Wow.
Wow. Amazing story.
Wow.
What's up? Follow me on Instagram.
JK, it's not the end. He and his companions escaped the wreck with just bumps and bruises. Some nearby rail workers helped Guizzardi repair the Italia, and they were back on the road within 3 hours.
Borghese realized that the bridges were too dangerous to cross and instead came up with an even more dangerous tactic. They would simply drive along the Trans-Siberian Railway instead, and that meant dodging the trains running along the same single rail, which quickly proved to be very treacherous. After one very narrow escape from an oncoming freighter, the prince called in some new favors and had his Italia added to the rail schedule as its own train line so they could avoid more close calls.
That's some prince stuff right there.
That is some prince stuff. It was in this way that Borghese made it all the way to Moscow while Goddard was still stuck in the Gobi Desert. And meanwhile, Cormier and Collignon kept going at a more modest pace and reached the European border in Russia. After blowing past Goddard and Du Tillys in the desert, Cormier later described his part of the journey as fairly luxurious. The Dédions had a hefty supply of traveling food and were welcomed with lavish parties being thrown by the racing delegations in almost every town in Russia. Sounds pretty cool. Perhaps part of the luxury was knowing that he was now quite far ahead of Goddard and quite far behind Borghese, so there's no need to rush. If so, that sense of complacency betrayed him, because Goddard, after nearly dying in the desert, somehow drove for 24 hours straight to catch up with the Dédions in Tomsk, Russia.
Ha-ha! It is I, Goddard!
But you were dying in the desert.
But I did not die! I am friends with the tribesmen!
We got a camel to drink a bunch of gas and walk out to the desert and meet you, then throw up all over your car.
Ha-ha! Never underestimate Goddard!
He's got a sword now. He's wearing a mask.
Yeah, dude. Goddard rules!
From there, Cormier, Collignon, and Goddard...
Let's go!
...agreed to resume...
It is me, Goddard!
...caravanning...
Let's go!
...through Siberia, but Goddard quickly ran into car troubles. To keep the Spiker running, he successfully plugged a hole in his rear axle with raw bacon. despite the ingenious and delicious quick fix, he was eventually unable to continue after the caravan tried to ford a river and his magneto got wet. Nobody wants a wet magneto.
Wait, did you say fjord? Fjord a river?
Fjord a river, yeah. Say it, Joe. Say it. I see your face.
a fjord is a body of water, but you try and ford a river.
What if you try to ford a fjord?
Yeah, you could ford a fjord.
Can you afford the a fjord?
You can afford a fjord the fjord.
Ah, you said it. Anyway, nobody wants that wet magneto. Goddard, thinking quickly, Goddard sent a telegram to Jacobus Spiker.
Telegram's like an AIM or a BBM.
It's like a two-way. Yeah, like, ever been on your two-way and you sent like an Excel sheet to your friend? It's basically the same thing.
Goddard sent a telegram to Jacobus Spiker requesting a mechanic and some spare parts. Spiker, who had previously concluded that Goddard was
a con man.
Hold on,
I have something really important. I have 401,000 Instagram followers now.
Nice.
So I need a really good 401k joke.
Do you have something about how you should probably start your 401k?
Yeah, guys, start your 401k. Oh, well, let's just go back to the dumb podcast.
We'll get back to more past guests, but right now, a word from our sponsors.
So anyway, Spiker had concluded that Goddard was a con man and unlikely to even start the race, but was back on board to help because of the huge publicity the raid was bringing his company. European audiences were hanging on to each and every dispatch of the journey.
Oh, man, can you imagine, dude, like, that's
right.
That's
the only thing going on at the time.
Yeah, they're sending telegraphs back, and they're like, they're stuck in the desert. It's like, oh, no. It's like, he went and befriended the tribesmen with pantomime.
He drove 24 hours straight.
Yeah, he's back. He caught up to the Dédions. That's what it was like.
Anyway, Spiker sent a young mechanic from the Spiker factory and a crate of spare parts along the Trans-Siberian Railroad to go and meet Goddard. But Goddard was not content to wait around. He put his car on a train to the nearest university hundreds of kilometers away, where he found an engineering professor who agreed to fix the magneto. And once the repairs were completed, Goddard doesn't really know how cars work. Goddard returned to...
What are you talking about? I got the bad guy from the X-Men wet.
Goddard returned
Who's
via train to the spot.
Who's to say if he is really a bad guy?
Where his car had broken down and raced once again to catch up with Cormier, picking up the Spiker mechanic and his extra parts along the way. I mean, this must have taken, like, this whole thing that I just read probably took, like, a week.
Oh, yeah. At least.
Or like a few days, because like he's getting on a train, he's going hundreds of kilometers. Trains aren't very fast, especially back then.
I bet it took a month.
A month? Mm-hmm. That would be pretty crazy.
He also had to like contact this professor, like find the professor, contact the professor, agree to meet him hundreds of miles away, set up his car to put on this train. Like,
right.
It took so long back then.
Dude, and he definitely had like a love affair in there.
Oh, there's definitely like a very steamy, extramarital. He's not married.
He had kids. He raised those kids up.
Tonight I am yours, but do not fall in love, for I, Goddard, belong to the raid.
Over the next 3,500 miles, Goddard was delayed when he found a baby who had fallen off the back of an ox cart, which he eventually was forced to deposit at a local church after failing to find the mother.
I bet
he was definitely planning on bringing that baby with him for a minute. He's like, you know what?
I kind of like this little baby.
How funny would it be if I showed up in Paris with a baby?
People are all, Goddard, why do you have a baby?
People would laugh so hard for so long.
And like me, that like I would be the funniest guy to have a baby.
Sure. Yeah, Borghese won, but does he have a baby?
Oh, sorry, I had to make a child by myself.
He was also briefly transported by a Russian countess who demanded passage in his car, but left her in a field after she got car sick on him.
Au revoir!
This could be a trilogy.
Oh, dude, for sure. This is definitely a Netflix original series. But Goddard drove day and night, including a final stretch of 29 hours straight to catch up with the Dedeons. He found them in Kazan, Russia, 2 weeks after separating near Tomsk. The same stretch took Borghese 3 weeks to cover, and it took Cormier nearly 5. So Goddard's definitely the best driver, I think.
He's a freaking ace.
He's a beast. This guy's a beast. He's going beast mode.
He's a problem.
But that grueling journey wasn't even the greatest trouble Goddard faced, though he didn't know it yet. When he was dashing across Russia, a court back in Amsterdam sentenced him to 18 months in prison for frauding the Dutch minister in Peking. That credit scam caught up with him.
Whoops.
Prince Borghese's lead continued to lengthen, even though he ran into his first...
Wait, he was thrown in jail for how long?
No, he just had like a warrant out.
Yeah, in Amsterdam. So when he gets back to Holland, he's going to jail for 18 months.
I love this guy, man.
Yeah, he's pretty good.
As soon as I finish the raid, I promise I will go to jail.
Prince Borghese's lead continued to lengthen, even though he ran into his first serious car trouble. While in Western Russia, the Atala's foot brake caused the floorboards to catch fire.
Oh, my God.
Flames crawled within inches of a spare gas tank before the journalist Barzini managed to put it out with the prince's fur coat. Why are you bringing a fur coat with you? Catastrophe was averted, but the Atala had to make the rest of the trip with only a handbrake. Oh my God, can you imagine? That said, the prince probably could have won the raid with no brakes. Because of Goddard's breakdown and Cormier's slow pace, after Moscow, the Atala was so far ahead that Borghese detoured 700 kilometers out of the way to be celebrated by the Tsar's government in St. Petersburg. So he's chilling with those Tsars.
I wonder what the average speed for these cars, or at least Borghese's car at the time was. It couldn't have been more than like 20 miles 15, per hour.
Yeah. Average? Yeah. Really low.
Yeah.
It's got 40 horsepower, though.
Yeah.
Pretty decent. How many horsepower does like a VW Beetle have?
Like 40.
And it also weighs about 2,000 pounds, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's got some pretty decent speed, I would say, this Atala. The Atala and Prince Borghese arrived in Paris on August 10th, just 2 months after departing on the journey that the other drivers speculated would take them through New Year's, if it was even possible at all. So this whole time we're thinking like, man, this probably took like a year. Two months.
That's crazy.
His bet on maximizing engine power rather than minimizing vehicle weight had clearly paid off, and the French welcomed
more
him
power,
like a
baby.
There it is. And the French welcomed him like a conquering hero, even though he was the raid's only Italian driver. After meeting again in Kazan, Goddard and Cormier decided to forget any bad blood from earlier in the race and caravan the rest of the way to Paris. All parties later said that the 265 miles from Kazan to Nizhny Novgorod, from Kazan to Nizhny Novgorod was the worst section of terrain they had faced. But after making it through, it was clear sailing to Moscow and the paved roads of Western Europe until Goddard was arrested as soon as they crossed into German territory.
Oh my God. Let him finish it.
The arrest was organized by Le Martin!
No!
Who'd been minimizing the progress of the Dutch-made Spyker in order to make the De Dion look better in comparison.
Ugh. It's slimy.
The raid's organizers worried that Goddard would decide to set off on his own and easily beat the two De Dions to Paris because the Spiker's advantage in power. Aren't they going to learn? He doesn't think like they do. He's a stand-up guy. What a slippery, slimy snails these guys are. The French cars finishing last would have been an embarrassment to their automotive industry, particularly if the entry was driven by the boastful Goddard. So they had him arrested.
But, I mean, Borghese has already won it in an Italian-made car. So,
well, they can't have it finished last.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true.
Cormier and Collignon regretfully moved on without Goddard. Yeah, right. The Spyker entry kept pace with them using a replacement driver who Jacobus Spyker had brought to the German border with the knowledge that Goddard might face legal trouble. Just a few miles from Paris, Goddard caught back up with the caravan at their final breakfast before completing the raid. He made a last desperate attempt to get behind the wheel of the Spyker and drive to the finish line, but he was pulled from the car by local police.
Man.
An emotional Dutally volunteered to drive the rest of the race, even though he didn't have a driver's license. He told Goddard, one of us has better do it. If it can't be you, it will have to be me. I'll take our end. Goddard's response, like hell you will. I'm not going to have you sugar up that old lady. What the hell do you think you are? A driver? Ha 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 ha. Ha 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 ha. I got my bang stick. I'm getting out of here.
You are foolish if you think you can use your hands and feet at the same time like me.
Cormier, Collignon, and the Spiker's replacement driver were welcomed to Paris with much celebration, just as Borghese was. Goddard didn't get to finish, but the Spiker took second place despite Le Martin's interference, and Goddard somehow wormed his way out of his 18-month fraud sentence.
Of course he did.
6 months after the conclusion of the Peking to Paris raid, he was on the starting line for a race around the world from New York to Paris via Japan.
We have to do that. Yeah, that's pass cool. Gas.
Well, it may not be well remembered today. Peking to Paris was a triumph for the automotive industry. By the end of the journey, Prince Borghese estimated the drivers had driven nearly 16,000 miles. And apart from Goddard's wet starter, not a single car had any major mechanical failures. The massive publicity that the raid generated also helped the European public accept cars into their lives once the next wave of companies like Fiat and Ford made them more affordable. But more than anything, it helped prove that the automobile, the horselage carriage, the chicho, the oil chariot, really can go anywhere as long as the driver is crazy enough to take it there.
That's what I'm talking about, maybe. And if I remember correctly, the winning margin was only by about 60 minutes. Borghese was able to beat the De Dions by 60 minutes.
This really makes me want to do the gambler.
I would, as someone who did the gambler in November, I would wait and do the one in the summer because Oregon in the summer is beautiful and Oregon in the winter, very cold and very wet.
I kind of like the misery of it, though. That's what's attractive to me. Okay, so maybe Joe and I will get some other donut staff members out there if James wants to take this one on. Dude, Joe, me, Job, mm-hmm. I think would definitely enjoy that.
Yeah. I'm just saying you're going to have a lot more fun in the summer.
I'm just saying I'm a glutton for punishment.
And it's not fun. You can't even do the race because like all the trails are closed and stuff. It's like not
fair enough.
Like I think maybe they don't even do it in the winter anymore.
No, they just did it. I saw people driving through the river.
Yeah.
It's a different vibe, it sounds like. The summer one is fun.
Yeah.
The winter one is...
I agree
with
you, Nolan. I'm kind of a mud cuck. I would love to get out there and you know, get stuck and have to, like, dig our way out and go through a little bit of trials.
I think you can really do that in the summer, and then it's, like, fun. Versus, like, the winter where it just, like, you're, like, and the end point is camping. So then you're just camping in the rain.
That's a fair point. That's a fair point.
Okay.
Like, it's just anyway. Like, you're miserable for almost 48 hours.
Okay. I mean, I do.
I've been miserable for like 10 months this year. I don't care.
More misery.
Anyway, guys, thanks again for listening. I'd just like to acknowledge our source for this episode, Mad Motorists, The Great Peking Perry Race of 07 by Alan Andrews.
Also want to give a big shout out to Greg Nix, our writer and researcher for this episode, and also Bridget, always our producer and editor.
Absolutely.
So without further ado, bye.
thanks for listening or watching Past Gas. We really appreciate it. This is like one of our favorite things to do. Follow the boys at Joe G. Weber, at James Pumphrey, at Nolan J. Sykes on all social media if you want to know more of our thoughts on mundane thanks for listening. Be kind.
I love you.
Keep it juiced.
See you next time.